take the idea of proof of stake as a base layer consensus mechanism and throw the idea away for right now. That is not what this is, and the problems that need to be solved to enable proof of stake as a second layer system instead of a standalone base layer are not the same. Proof of stake is essentially a federation, but where anyone can join and can't be stopped from doing so, and with a mechanism to punish members for acting malicious. As a base layer, that creates all kinds of existential issues, like the objectivity of a slashing penalty. Proof of stake as a second layer does not have that problem when the bonds for slashing are on the main chain, governed by proof of work. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And there is a new development in the concept of sidechains, in the management of a coin pool, so to speak, for some other application or some other chain called spider chains. So we've got a ton of these different proposals now, and we've been talking a lot about this because of an article series and just so much going on. It did drive chains drama and all of that stuff. And I thought it was interesting that this has kind of surfaced in the midst of all of this. I guess it's just opportune. But this is a really clever proposal, and I talk about it in the guys' take afterward in the commentary that I've been very interested to see how proof of stake could be done on top of Bitcoin because it solves the more fundamental problems of proof of stake if you have a genuine source of truth as to who owns what in the context of stake. And Shinobi, in this article, this is a piece by Shinobi, Brian Trolls on Bitcoin Magazine, and it is introducing this idea in a pretty high level, just kind of like a general sense. It's like, okay, how do we describe it? And then there's also an article by Jamison Lopp, which is far more, it digs into the weeds a little bit more. And he talks about the security model and, you know, how many signers there would be and like what would be the optimum. But I kind of felt this one was a better introduction to the concept, and whether or not we will read Lopp's article, I don't know, but I will link to it just in case so that you can kind of do a dive down there if you want to as well. It's definitely a great one to read if you are interested in this topic. But we are going to just jump right into this article because it's really good and spider chains seem really clever. I'm intrigued by this idea. This episode is brought to you by the Fold debit card that gets sats back on everything in your life. Bought some stuff on Amazon yesterday and I got 2.5% in sats. Think about that. I spent $100 on Amazon and I get $2.50 in sats. If you are not doing this, and there's free sats, I think it's like 100,000 sats still just for signing up for the free version, by the way, you'll see all the details at bitcoinaudible.com/fold. And this is also brought to you by Nodeless. I want you guys to check out Nodeless because this is the perfect place to send all of the merchants, all of the people online, the fundraisers, the projects, the charities, these things that want to plug into Bitcoin and want to be able to say, I accept Bitcoin, but don't want any of the hassles of setting up a node, of doing channel management, of knowing the difference between Bitcoin and Lightning. It just works for them. That is Nodeless. Check out the link in the show notes, and don't forget my 10,000 sat offer if you use my link and set up your donation page. And lastly, the Cold Card hardware wallet, which is where all of the funds that you get in Nodeless when you set up your store or whatever, they're going to send it directly to your Cold Card. And I gotta tell you again, I just set one up the other day with while I was doing a video, and I never cease to just kind of be like, it's so cool with the NFC on the Nunchuck wallet. I'm going to do a video on that soon because it's just magic. But check them out at bitcoinaudible.com/coldcard. With that, let's get into today's article. And it's titled, Spider Chains, a Proof of Stake Second Layer, by Shinobi. Botanics Labs has designed a mechanism for governing a two-way pegged Bitcoin sidechain system with proof of stake collateralized with BTC. This is an extension to my previous article series discussing the different sidechain proposals that exist. Those articles can be found here: space chains, space chain use cases, soft chains, drive chains, federated chains, and the trade-offs of sidechains. Botanix Labs has proposed a completely new sidechain design recently called Spider Chains, for the purposes of porting the Ethereum virtual machine to a platform anchored to the Bitcoin network. The architecture is a pretty large deviation from most prior proposals for concrete designs. Firstly, it does not involve miners directly in consensus or use merge mining in any of its variant forms. Secondly, it uses multisig and escrow bonds to create a second layer proof of stake system on top of Bitcoin. Third, it does not require any changes to Bitcoin in order to deploy. The first thing to clarify is that, technically speaking, the Spider Chain isn't really the sidechain. Any sidechain deployed utilizing Spider Chains would sit above the Spider Chain, which sits above the base layer on the main chain. Sidechain blocks would be produced independently by the stakers, referred to as orchestrators in the paper, in the consensus system. The Spider Chain, rather than being the actual sidechain, is a sort of collateral layer, facilitating the custody of users' funds and stakers' bonds on the main chain. Think of it like the middle of the sandwich between the sidechain and the main chain. The Proof of Stake variant. To get a better idea of how the system works, let's go through how the Botanix EVM chain interacts with the Spider Chain layer. One of the first uses the system makes of the Bitcoin blockchain, aside from actually custodying funds backing the sidechain tokens, is the selection of a block constructor. Proof-of-stake chains require a selection process for which staker actually puts blocks together from the transactions in the mempool. In proof-of-work, all miners do this independently, and whoever gets lucky and finds a valid block header hash has their block accepted into the blockchain. Since the entire point of proof-of-stake is to do away with energy-intensive randomizing of who selects the next block, these systems need another solution. They use a verifiably random function, or VRF, a function that allows all participants to verify the outcome is actually random and not biased or deterministic. Spider chains make use of Bitcoin block hashes in order to acquire verifiable randomness. Just like other proof-of-stake systems, Botanix divides the blockchain into discrete sections called epochs, which are finalized periodically, and a new block constructor is chosen. At the start of an epoch, the main chain block hash is taken and applied as a source of randomness to all the stakers to choose the new block constructor. After 6 blocks, to account for the possibility of reorgs, the network transitions to the new block constructor for that epoch. Now, this describes the way the proof-of-stake system handles block construction on the sidechain and reaching consensus on whose turn it is. Time to get to how this all interacts with the Spider Chain, and what exactly a Spider Chain is. The Spider Chain. In addition to using it periodically for selecting a block constructor, the sidechain also uses the VRF, the verifiable random function, to select a random subset of the stakers to construct a multisig address for deposits into the sidechain, every single Bitcoin block. That's right, a random set of members for the PEGS multisig. Unlike a federated sidechain, which custodies funds in addresses composed of the entire set of the federation membership, spider chains break each deposit or change from transactions pegging out of the sidechain off into a unique address, depending on the main chain block it confirms is made up of a random subset of the set of stakers. In other words, if there are 50 people staking at any given block height, 10 are randomly selected to be key holders for any deposits occurring in the next block. This may intuitively seem rather crazy, but there are a few sound logical reasons for it. It segregates risk of funds from malicious parties. Most people think of theft, but even loss of liveness can be a disaster for systems like this. Think of a federated sidechain. You don't need a malicious majority to cause a massive problem, just a malicious minority. If a federation requires a two-thirds threshold to move coins, well then just one-third plus one member is enough to keep those coins frozen. This is why Liquid has a time-delayed emergency recovery path with Blockstream-held keys to prevent permanent coin loss in that situation. You don't even need any malicious actors, strictly speaking. Just key loss could create that problem. By breaking up deposits into isolated subset keys with random members, you mitigate, not solve, problems like this. If keys were lost, or a malicious actor was able to gain enough staking percentage in the system to stall or steal, they statistically will never have access to the entirety of the funds in the spider chain. Each block has totally independent odds of constructing a deposit address controlled by a malicious majority, or impeded by a malicious minority. And if those conditions are met, only the funds deposited or rolled over through change from withdrawals in that specific block will be at risk, instead of the entirety of the sidechain's funds. There is also another interesting security property that derives from how withdrawals are handled. Any sidechain peg mechanism that doesn't aggregate all deposits into a single rolling UTXO begs the question of which UTXOs to use for fulfilling withdrawals. The spider chain design has settled on last in, first out, or LIFO, meaning that any withdrawals from the sidechain will be processed using the most recently deposited UTXOs. Think of this in the context of malicious entities joining the set of stakers in order to steal funds from the spider chain. All the money that was deposited before those malicious entities became a majority is completely safe and firewalled from them until any withdrawal requirements start necessitating spending those funds and rotating the change into new addresses. Now, even after they are the majority of stakers, they will only have access to funds where they randomly wind up as the majority of the key members in the deposit address creation protocol. So even after they have entered and taken over, so to say, they will not have full access to all funds deposited after that fact because of the deposit address creation using a VRF. This chain of randomly constructed multisigs is the spider chain, the pegging mechanism used to lock and unlock coins into and out of the sidechain. The staking bonds. The last piece of any proof-of-stake system is bonds, and it's pretty simple. If stakers aren't required to put anything up for collateral in exchange for participation in the consensus mechanism, then there is nothing that can be taken from them as a penalty for malicious behavior. This is accomplished by, you guessed it, using the spider chain. The same way deposit addresses are generated for users, each block a new deposit address is generated for people who want to stake on the sidechain to deposit a bond into a multisig composed of a random set of existing stakers. Once this bond is confirmed, the new member is recognized as a staker and included in the overall set that the new block constructors and deposit address members are selected from. At that point, if a staker fails to respond and stay online or engages in malicious behavior, they can be penalized through slashing, and if necessary, ultimately removed from the set of stakers by slashing the entire staking bond. The nice thing about the way this is done is the slashing policy, i.e. the amount in penalties for specific actions or misbehaviors, is not programmatic or social. It's both. Slashing occurs programmatically on the base layer of the main chain, but is initiated socially by the key holders of a staking bond. This means there is potential for things to be a little messy, but flexibility to fine-tune things to an equilibrium that keeps things functioning in a way beneficial to stakers and users. Gluing it all together. Take the idea of proof-of-stake as a base layer consensus mechanism, and throw the idea away for right now. That is not what this is, and the problems that need to be solved to enable proof of stake as a second layer system instead of a standalone base layer are not the same. Proof of stake is essentially a federation, but where anyone can join and can't be stopped from doing so, and with a mechanism to punish members for acting malicious. As a base layer, that creates all kinds of existential issues, like the objectivity of a slashing penalty. Proof of stake as a second layer does not have that problem when the bonds for slashing are on the main chain, governed by proof of work. The problem with proof of stake as a second layer is how do you guarantee that new members cannot be kept out of the, quote, federation? If all the funds are custodied by the current members, a majority or malicious minority of 1/3 plus 1 could prevent any funds from being transferred to a multisig with new members included. They could be stopped from joining. The way the deposits and staking bonds make use of the spider chain and its provably randomly generated multisigs composed of subgroups of the federation, it elegantly solves that problem of current members being able to exclude new members. Everything governing the address members and new entrants is provably verifiable and enforced by second layer consensus with information viewable on the main chain, governed by proof of work. Once someone posts a bond, they're part of the set that gets selected to custody deposits and other staking bonds. It's all there and verifiable. It also creates some interesting security properties and dynamics based on how it works. In a federated sidechain, the instant funds were rotated into multisigs composed of enough malicious entities, the entirety of the sidechain's funds are compromised. With a spider chain, the entrance of a new malicious majority can be almost completely mitigated if it is recognized quickly. Just ceasing new deposits until slashing can trim out enough malicious participants can keep the amount of funds at risk, limited to the statistical portion of new deposits that wound up in addresses they control, since they became the majority. They would be unable to slash any old staking bonds from before their entrance, but pre-existing members would be able to statistically slash a portion of their bonds. As long as the size of individual multisigs are balanced right with the total number of stakers and the value of all deposits compared with staking bonds, this could be a very workable system. Overall, it is a very interesting proposal that proposes interesting solutions to the problems of upgrading federations to a proof-of-stake system. The ability for anyone to join, mechanisms for protecting against malicious members, and an incentive to participate because the stakers can split transaction fees. The kicker? Why should you care? It doesn't require any fork at all to enable. So it's going to happen. This episode is brought to you by Nodeless.io. Trying to get people to accept Bitcoin, especially your friends or normies or pre-coiners, people who are kind of on the edge and interested, but don't want the complexity of BTC Pay server, don't want the complexity of running their own node. They just want to be able to plug it into their website and say, look, I'm a merchant, I'm a charity, I'm a fundraiser, I'm a project, and we accept Bitcoin, Lightning or on-chain. And all they need is an address. No servers, no channel management, no programming, no trying to figure out how to design your front end. They can just plug it straight into WooCommerce, make their fundraiser or donation page, their paywalls, whatever it is they want to do, literally in a matter of a couple of minutes, share the link, and off you go. I've been really interested in this project for a while, and I'm super stoked that they have decided to support Bitcoin Audible. And in an effort to try to bring attention to the project, because I think more people, if you have someone who wants to accept Bitcoin, give them the easy, no-brainer option. And if you want to set up your donation page, just go try out the service. There's no obligation, there's no subscription, there's no like long-term contract or anything. You literally just go set up an email, plug in your address, make a donation page, send me the link, or tag it on a Noster or Twitter, and I will donate 10,000 sats to your cause. It's been really cool to see the number of people who have done this, and Finally taken the moment to go check out Nodeless, and I've been getting a lot of great feedback from you guys. So it's exciting and it's fun. It's fun. You want 10,000 sats? I will send you 10,000 sats. Use my link to set up your page. It's bitcoinaudible.com/nodeless. Then post it on socials, tag me, and I'll throw some sats your way. All the details will be right there in the show notes. All right. So this is a really clever new design, new type of system for how to create a trust minimized peg in and peg out from a sidechain, from a external model or node system, whatever you want to call it, for transactions, payments, whatever. And what's interesting about the spider chain specifically is that it's kind of a generic peg in and peg out thing, which means that you could essentially run Liquid with spider chain instead of the current Federation design. You could run Fedimint with a spider chain instead of the current custodial and or multi-sig federated sort of design. So in the same way that Shinobi describes in this one, that it's kind of like between the two layers, right? Is that there's the main chain, and then in the middle of the sandwich, there's a spider chain, and then on top of it is whatever chain you have. Well, the thing about that is that the chain on top is completely arbitrary. So in that sense, it's actually a lot like drive chains, except that you don't have to, nobody has to argue about a bunch of soft forks. But you can do whatever you want with it. I mean, the whole point that Botanix is doing this is to make the Ethereum virtual machine on top of Bitcoin. Now, and I want to address, and I think Shinobi does a really good job tackling this idea about where proof of stake is useful and where proof of stake falls apart. And this is something that we've talked about in the past on the show, and I've alluded to, and I've kind of casually thought about for a really long time, going back honestly to really kind of the early days of Liquid and how to think about sidechains. And I kept thinking that somebody would figure this out. And I think we even talked about this in one of the most recent, which wasn't very recent, episodes of discussing and kind of digging into proof of stake, is that proof of stake is not a good consensus mechanism when the truth that you are referencing as to who owns what stake is the thing that the proof of stake is trying to set its punishment by. In the sense that, like, when you're looking at a purely proof of stake system, and I love the term or the phrase, actually. Let me find the Where is it? There's a quote here. It says, okay, take the idea of proof of stake as a base layer consensus mechanism and throw the idea away for right now. That is not what this is. And the problems that need to be solved to enable proof of stake as a second layer system instead of a standalone base layer are not the same. Proof of stake is essentially a federation, but where anyone can join and can't be stopped from doing so, and with a mechanism to punish members for acting malicious. As a base layer, that creates all kinds of existential issues, like the objectivity of a slashing penalty. Proof of stake as a second layer does not have that problem when the bonds for slashing are on the main chain, governed by proof of work. So I want to expand what this means exactly. So As a base layer, that creates all kinds of existential issues like the objectivity of a slashing penalty. So the reason proof of stake is not a fundamentally sound consensus mechanism, and it has all of these really potentially bad problems, is that in order to decide, or in order to have the history to prove that someone has acted maliciously, or that someone has some subset, like has control or has offered up some set of funds in order to be slashed, in order to be punished by any wrongdoing in the proof of stake system, it uses the proof of stake history to decide who owns what. So it's a self-referential thing. It's like saying, We're going to use this history in order to decide who is going to be able to extend the history. But then when someone acts maliciously, we're going to use that same history that the malicious actor is able to extend as our reference for who we should be able to punish. So there's this circular problem of there's no fundamental truth to work off of. And we talk about a bunch of different ways in which this is a problem and the kind of like multi-layers of complication, and the fact that also in a proof of stake system, you can essentially create the longest potential. Because there's no real cost to creating new history, no cost as in no proof of work cost, you could exit. There's the nothing at stake problem. So like, let's say somebody has keys to like 90% of the funds and they sell it all for proof of work. For Bitcoin, which has proof of work. So they can't reverse the proof of work. Well, technically, there's still a history out there that's just a few blocks deep right now in which they own 90% of the keys on Ethereum or on some proof of stake system, but they don't own them anymore. They have nothing at stake. But if they can regenerate the most recent few blocks based on when they did have 90% of the keys, well, then they can still own 90% of the keys. They can just have it that their transaction never went through, but they still own all the Bitcoin. Now, the actual Ethereum, Casper, whatever system is a lot more convoluted than that, and they're trying to make self-referentials and loops and all sorts of things to try to get around that. But at the end of the day, every proof-of-stake system has these sort of, like he says, existential crises or existential issues, where ultimately it's using the history that it has as proof of wrongdoing and as the proof of who owns what. However, you don't have this problem when you have an independent, trustless consensus mechanism in proof of work that you can leverage for the bonds, for who owns the stake. The stake must be external to the history in question that we are trying to decide is malicious or not. And this was always an avenue that I hoped and kind of imagined there would be some really fascinating developments in. And this is kind of the first major protocol design that kind of seems like it's found a new, extremely interesting means of mitigating that trust and creating a legitimate proof of stake system on top of the proof of work consensus, on top of the fundamental ownership of the Bitcoin system. Now, if you want kind of a simplified version, this is something that I always had specifically in my mind of how we might accomplish proof of stake or an interesting second layer system, is that it's essentially what darknet markets have done in the past, and designs for certain types of escrow. Like, one of the things about like a lot of darknet markets is there was actually an independent darknet market that was what was it called? I looked into it at some point and I cannot remember what it was called, but there was one that would do a 2-of-2 multi-sig, or essentially if the buyer and the seller didn't come to an agreement, then no one got the funds. And there were also some really clever, I think even Satoshi came up with a handful of different systems like this, where you could have a proof of burn, where in order to engage in a transaction with a buyer, the seller also had to put up into a sort of a multi-sig system the exact same amount of funds that the buyer had at risk, that the buyer could essentially destroy. So it would essentially go to a proof of burn address. So even if the seller tried to cheat, the buyer could punish to the point that no one really got any funds. Everyone essentially just lost everything. But because of that, you have this insanely strong incentive for everyone to sort out the transaction details, for the thing to go through cleanly, or to come to some sort of an agreement so that not everybody's losing their funds. And I always wondered if there was some means of having that sort of a thing where somebody could stake, provide a bond, provide a proof of this address or this amount, and then you could have a secondary system that distributed the keys through CTV updates. But again, this would be something that required a soft fork. This was just kind of like some loose, really kind of super vague concept of how the users could essentially just punish If for some reason their withdrawals weren't going through, like the orchestrator or the manager of the staking system or the pool or whatever it was not allowing withdrawals, well, then essentially the users could vote, maybe even by weight of their stake, for how much they could punish the staking agent. So even if like they put in like they secretly put in like 90% of the funds into this pool, well, then the 10% of the funds could still destroy 10% of the funds, which would be the amount that they would be trying to steal from any of the users. I mean, obviously there's not like a legitimate construction of this or any concrete system to actually make this happen. It's just kind of a general idea, is that like there's a lot of tools and a lot of mechanisms by which we could utilize that sort of a system. And I really love, kind of probably my favorite thing about this construction is that even though you're still completely creating a quote-unquote sidechain token, you're just creating an arbitrary shitcoin, just like all of these, really, there's some degree, there's not really any degree of verifiability outside of what the sidechain system enables. So it's completely dependent on what sort of software you're running as to whether or not you have a quote-unquote proof that you have funds on the main chain. So depending on the architecture, it seems like all of these things still have this rough or not entirely provable one-to-one peg problem. However, I'd be curious to dig a little bit deeper into the spider chain and, you know, what kind of system are they doing, or, you know, how could you have some sort of a proof of reserves? Because the interesting thing about a system like this is, because this is another cryptographic system, you could essentially have proof of liability on the node side or on the sidechain side for how many withstanding or outstanding coins or outstanding balances are there. And then if you have a clearly defined multi-sigs and addresses and balances on the main chain, well, you could just know that those are one-to-one. But again, it's still extremely reliant on how the entire thing is orchestrated, because you could do one that was completely blind, that nobody had any idea. You could do one that's e-cash. Like I said, it's totally arbitrary. This is purely a means to distribute the trust, to move in and out of the fund structure or the reserve structure of the spider chain, how to move in and out of that on the main chain without having any of the entities that are putting up bonds, while having any of the entities that are able to sign have to put up funds at risk to be decided upon by other actors in the system to decide whether or not they are malicious or purposefully screwing something up or accidentally screwing something up, there's a bug, you know, whatever it is. And it does seem very messy. It does seem like, because it's like part social, part programmatic, like social systems don't work phenomenally well. But with a source of truth, with a kind of proof of work foundation, and then clever, the other really clever thing here is the fact that new members can't get old addresses unless somebody's submitting new withdrawals. So that if you see that new malicious members are trying to get a hold of the system or trying to control all of the funds, it seems like the network has this, the amount of capital that has real age on it and the orchestrators or the stakers that have been in the system long enough that, because they also have time staked into the system with their bonds, and you have that verifiable, that proof of time in the Bitcoin time chain, because you cannot reverse it, or that it's provably insanely costly to do so. If there's any risk, seeming risk or maliciousness from new signers into the system, it basically only affects the people immediately moving to move funds into the system, which, if there was any appearance of malicious actors at play, well, then nobody would give them any funds. So it's interesting because it uses that depth as a tool to keep a static set for certain balances of the spider chain. So there's a balance 100 blocks ago, there's a balance 50 blocks. Well, every single block, it seems like, has a balance. And there's new multi-sig from all the orchestrators trying to participate in this. That the funds from 100 blocks ago are still managed by orchestrators that were there 100 blocks ago. And any new stakers who put up their bond to join into the staking process only have any chance of being a signer in everything past their bond. So if 90% of the funds, 99% of the funds have already been deposited into the sidechain or into the spider chain system, prior, and there's only like a 1% tip of new deposits going into the spider chain, well, anybody who joins, even if they have 99% of the stake in those specific blocks, and they're, you know, trying to completely take over the system or something, they still can't, they still have zero access for 99% of the funds, because they're already, they're all in the past, or they're all built on orchestrator, on multisigs that they did not have a bond for, that they can't participate in. So I'm going to try to dig through the white paper and get like really good specifics, because the other piece that I read on this is Jameson Lopp's piece, which just came out like at the exact same time. It was like 2 days ago, I think. But I'll link to that one as well, because his has got a couple of little pieces and tidbits in it that I think clear up some things in Shinobi's piece, and then vice versa. But I want to dig through the white paper. I still kind of have like a vague idea of how this thing works. But it seems really clever that it's using the proof of time with Bitcoin, which is the only, which is the problem with proof of stake as its own consensus mechanism, is that it doesn't have a proof of time because it's using itself, and itself is not a proof of time because you're trying to punish, you know, someone trying to screw with the sense of time. So there's just no canonical truth in a full-on proof of stake system, and I think it has an existential problem that no matter how convoluted you make it, it's just like Terra USD and Luna, is that it will work for some span of time, but eventually, if there is any depeg, it's just going to spiral out of control. And I think, I honestly already think, like with the way the staking looks on the Ethereum system, and the fact that staking is can essentially be permissioned, in a sense, like it's insanely difficult to become one, and everybody's just in like kind of a pool, and I think the overwhelming majority of it is custodian right now. I could be wrong about the degree to which it is, but I know it's growing. I know the last time I looked at it, at least it was heading in that direction. And it seems like the obvious end, which, I mean, you know, I've even said before that I think what Ethereum needs to do is just go more centralized so that it can kind of solve its problems and just move quick. But ultimately, the problem is, as soon as there's a, from a monetary perspective, at the end of the day, this all competes as a monetary unit. And regardless of how good the technology is built on Ethereum, if you have an independent trust mechanism to peg into one of these systems, and this one specifically, I mean, this is the kind of crazy element right here, is that if this actually makes a proof of stake that is better than the overwhelming majority of centralized proof of stake coins out there that just, you know, sold to a bunch of VCs or, you know, gave it to the developers or something. Like, I mean, some of these things have extremely few validators or signers. If you could have a system, if you could have a half decent peg in, peg out system that allowed you to do the Ethereum virtual machine, pegging into it with Bitcoin, that was better than strictly custodian, and actually had a few rather really interesting improvements that I can't come up with any like extremely bad or like extremely obvious, maybe is the better term. Something may absolutely be there that I'm not putting my finger on. I've been reading about this for 2 days, but it seems like a really significant improvement over the idea of just a blanket federation, of just having multi-sig among, you know, 60 parties or whatever. This, the ability to take those 60 parties, segment out the amount of capital at risk with any subset of those 60 parties, and then find, and using Bitcoin not only as your source of time and your source of settlement, like when it is that you can't go backwards, or that this is the quote-unquote canonical truth of this sidechain, but then also using Bitcoin as your independent means of randomness so that you can verify against the Bitcoin blockchain what information is being used to select the multisig themselves. So the output of the selection and the input of the randomness is on the Bitcoin chain, in like irreversible on the chain. And then any attacker in the pool of signers does not even know, or cannot know at least, whether he will actually have the majority. He would actually have controlling ability to, essentially, quote unquote, take over the system, because there's only a certain probability that their key will be in the mix. But also that strictly the amount of funds that they have access to is limited to the length of time of their involvement in the system, or involvement in the deposit and withdrawal, the movement in and out of the spider chain. That's pretty cool. That's a pretty awesome, you know, this is really interesting in the context of the UTX Oracle stuff as well, because it's interesting, like there is so much information, there is so much utility in just having this canonical sense of time, that this is past and here is this data from the market of participants and transactions that have gone through, and to be the ability to use the node. And actually, I was talking to Steve. Steve and Daniel are the ones who wrote that article and came up with the idea of the UTX Oracle, of using the transaction data, the hard transaction data on the Bitcoin chain, to find the lines, to find the patterns of exactly $100, exactly $1,000 denominated transactions, like the fact that we think in very explicit denominations, and we happen to make transactions of round amounts to a degree that you can actually see them in the data. And they've actually put together a model that is essentially 99% accurate as to what the market price of Bitcoin is in dollars, just from running a node and looking at the UTXO set. And it allows everyone to independently verify, because I know exactly what data is going into determining the Bitcoin price. And I can take that exact same math problem on my exact same node with no third party, no, you know, official exchange, Binance or Coinbase or anything being some source of truth, that where that one independent exchange or whatever may decide to wash trade or put up a bunch of fake paper coins in their exchange to suppress the price. Instead, we look at our node, we look at the UTXO set, and we calculate what, based on looking for transactions in round amounts, you can trace this line through the Bitcoin chain, which is 99% accurate to the Bitcoin price. In that same way, like there's just kind of this ocean of things that I think we can do with this source of information. And I like the idea of using it as a kind of provable form of randomness, or provable source of randomness. And then, of course, the more obvious of settling side chains in individual transactions, of like what the current state of it is. And that's still something, I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm just kind of a nerd for CTV lately, because it seems fascinating to me that you can have hidden entirely behind a signature, so that it's, and you know, in Taproot or whatever, so that it's not actually visible unless somebody executes it. You can have a single transaction that has an out, like basically has committed to thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of individual outputs of individual amounts, where there's nothing that transaction can do except unroll to that. And I just feel like that specifically, and a couple other tools, really lend themselves to having so much optionality that we just really haven't explored, or we've been trying to. I mean, look at all the people doing all this work. I mean, he looked at the freaking list at the beginning of this of soft chains, space chains, spider chains. I'm actually kind of really sick of the whole chain thing. And to be honest, I don't think I really like the name spider chain. I don't know why. It's just, I don't know. Maybe it'll grow on me. But it seems like a really clever way to have a trust minimized pool of funds that can be used to as essentially a form of, like, all of this is really a mode of trying to have some degree of proof of reserves, where you can just trustlessly pool funds into a group, and then that entire group can independently run completely different sets of software, completely different structure of nodes or transactions or whatever. And none of the participants in that system can unilaterally control, halt, or steal from that system. This seems like a pretty great, pretty fascinating, at least, one I'm going to definitely dig more into. There may be something kind of glaringly obvious or like really bad when you think about some of the edge cases that might kind of put this in a, you know, tough spot, but I haven't found one yet, or I hadn't thought of one. It'd be interesting to keep reading other people's assessments and, kind of stress test this thing. And I'm still really interested to see how development or kind of the thinking and design around ARC is changing, because I know some more like kind of technical, like main things of like how long blocks are and how many, like whether it's CoinJoin and these sorts of things have been changed or are in a sense arbitrary. They're not necessary to it. But I'll be perfectly honest, it's really interesting. I'm excited to kind of see this space for all the kind of drama and mess, especially around like the drive chains and stuff recently. It's interesting to see so much discussion around this part of Bitcoin because it's just not been there. And I think it's largely in the history, I think it's just because it's been far more difficult to issue shitcoins on top of Bitcoin, which means we're probably going to get a lot of that. If you can run the EV, if you can run the Ethereum virtual machine, God knows what that's going to produce on whatever sidechain gets set up. But the thing is on the Bitcoin chain, it's still just multi-sig and Bitcoin. So there's not really, it's about as independent or as external to Bitcoin as it gets, as far as how much that even affects us, because all Bitcoin cares about is the multi-sig. All it cares about is the addresses, and there's no change to any of those things. It doesn't need any special hash function or, you know, some hash escrow or an opcode, anything like that. This is just a clever architecture. The spider chain has nothing to do with the EVM. Like, the spider chain is completely independent. Again, going back to the idea of the sandwich, it is just a way to pool funds and mitigate the degree of trust that any subset of the people controlling that pool of funds has over them, and that they actually have to put up Bitcoin essentially as collateral to the fact that they won't be found cheating by the rest of the community. Because if they are, they're going to lose it. So maybe the best way to visualize this or think about it conceptually is as a large permissionless pool of collateralized Bitcoin. It's essentially insured with a community punishment mechanism that has a random signer selection that isn't based on proof of work, but it is derived from proof of work that has occurred. Honestly, to me, that is better than the drive chain option, because this is the thing that didn't get, that really bothered me about the hash rate escrow and the drive chain thing, is that the funds are all in one pool, and if it is permissionless to provide a hash. So there's no, this is why the federated system, the strictly federated system, which is just kind of distributed custodians, there's nothing magic about it. It's just kind of crazy because you can distribute this globally, and Bitcoin provides this truly independent form of multisig. So the federated model is fascinating if you look at it just in comparison to the fiat and the banking system that we have today, is that that's not even possible. Like, there's no federation of banks. Like, one bank controls the essentially the master key to the ledger. All the money in the system is explicitly permissioned, and it only exists because someone with authority has the permission to say it exists. So multisig in that situation is fundamentally not possible. Like, you can make a facade and kind of like call it that, but at the end of the day, it has absolutely no effect. It's functionally impossible. So just that concept on top of Bitcoin, the fact that you can actually have one of 60 keys and it literally only controls 1/60th of the key and nobody can change that and you don't need anybody's permission, that is cool. That's a unique thing that Bitcoin can do, that post Bitcoin's existence is possible, that just wasn't before. So going back to comparing this to drive chains, it was a little bit of a tangent, but comparing this to drive chains is that the thing about the Federation is that you can actually know who is part of the Federation, which means you can be deliberate and thinking about breaking up that trust. What do I want to, you know, in the Federation, I want to have something that's got a broad set of jurisdictions, that has companies that have been a long time in the space. Like, you can actually think about it in a trust relationship. Like, this is the point of a trustless money or a trust minimized monetary structure or architecture. And why money works, why money helps societies, then you basically have this totem in order to then decide who to trust, who to build relationships with. And there's another great piece actually by Lop that I think we're going to read on the show, of sovereignty versus society. And I think it's a really great, really great framing to remember that the point of all this is to rebuild trust in society. Like, there's no way to have trustless everything. You don't even want trustless everything. What you want is an anchor, a totem, so to speak, in order to lean on, so that as trust breaks down, when it inevitably does in any system, there's a means to protect yourself. There's a underlying set of fundamental rules or fundamental restrictions which allow us to build trusted relationships on top of it. Because, you know, it's just like everything in the universe, right? It's all relative. There's no speed except in relation to some other object. Well, the same goes for trust and value and all of those other things in our economic systems. Now, going back to the problem with federations is that they don't really have any stake in the system. I mean, they do because they're functionaries of the system. As long as it's running, they have income, especially if, you know, if it's successful. This is an asset, and they will lose their place in the asset if they try to attack it. But at the end of the day, if an attack could be successful and an attack is more profitable than keeping the asset or maintaining it, there's an incentive to do that. Now, the problem that bugs me so much with the drive chains, and I think a couple of the people that I was talking to didn't quite understand down to the granular level how some of the things work, and I was trying to work through the details. But what I keep running into, and I haven't found an answer for, is that because it's permissionless, because it's pure hash rate, an attacker doesn't have to be involved in it. An attacker doesn't have to care whether or not it's successful. If they have the hash power, they can just kind of jump in and try to take funds. Now, they do have to compete with the rest of the hash power for an extended period of time. But who's to say most miners, if they're getting the fees regardless, why would they necessarily care about what's happening on the drive chain? What if it's just a bunch of pools that are just blind merge mining without looking at anything? And there's no punishment, there's no major incentive for the external actor or the external miner to not try to get the coins if they don't put anything at stake. They don't risk losing anything. They're going to get the transaction fees either from people trying to leave the drive chain, people freaking out. Like, they don't really have to care about any of it because they're just getting fees on the main chain. And if it doesn't work, then the stuff stays locked and they can just kind of like whatever. But there's not really any cost to just continuing the, because they're only mining Bitcoin. That's it. They can blind merge mine as many other drive chains as they want. They can try it on 30 drive chains at the exact same time, or they can just keep bouncing around. Maybe eventually they'll succeed. But because it's just locked with hash rate, and all of the capital that they get is on the main chain, no one can stop them from continuing to get the fees from the Bitcoin main chain, from all the drive chains that they're attacking. And because of the hash rate escrow, nobody can lock them out of attacking the drive chains. It's as permissionless as hash rate. And since it's profitable for a completely different reason, using mining on the main chain, well, then it's not providing any stake or any reason for them to care about the drive chain. You know, they talk about all this all the time, miner incentives. Well, they're just going to do whatever's most profitable. Therefore, they're going to force through BIP 300. They're going to force through and we're going to activate drive chains.
I don't know. That kind of sounds like, if you believe that incentive, that they're just going to do whatever's most profitable.
And there's nothing at stake for them to not try and steal any of the funds on the drive chain.
Well, then that kind of seems like an argument that the miners are going to steal if they get the opportunity to.
Well, the interesting thing about spider chains and why I thought proof of stake actually had a chance as a layer two. It had an interesting place where if it could use Bitcoin as the canonical consensus as to what its history is, well, then it doesn't have that existential proof of stake problem. Any other potential problems or trade-offs aside. But that to me makes it an interesting means to accomplish this, to create a pool of funds, a kind of a one-to-one backing that you can use in some completely arbitrary set of applications. Now, I think the notion or the fact that the attempt is to, or the initial purpose is to create the Ethereum virtual machine, is going to make a lot of people, myself included, kind of want to gag. However, on the other hand, it does prove the adage that whatever actually is valuable over there, the tech that is useful, the code platform solidity that has been built, all of it will eventually be built on top of Bitcoin. And I think really kind of the altcoin market, the shitcoin market, the idea of like a floating token has really kind of, I think it's over its peak. I don't think it ever goes back to what it has been. Like the vast majority of capital that went into these systems were done for gambling purposes. And even most of the things built were done to speculate and create gambling markets on the tokens that they're trying to gamble for. So they created gambling platform tokens for gambling tokens on the platform. And as we covered in depth in Only the Strong Survive, which I will have a link to, just for any of those who haven't listened to it, is that there's no genuine underlying capital or capital market, capital formation that's going underneath any of it. It's all pure. It is finance for the sake of finance. And I'm not so sure. There will be another quote unquote bull market, but there will just be so much left that won't have another bounce, that just will kind of stay in the doldrums. Like there's such a wake of just crap, of just tokens created so that VCs could get in, get a bunch of tokens, and then dump it days later, where nobody cared about any of the projects. It was just, how do we issue a new token? So much so that there's no way to even police this. The SEC is already, this is interesting to think about, is that the SEC, there's no way for them to even litigate against all of the tokens out there. In fact, if they figure out a way to do it, there's like 1.8 million of them. If they figure out a way to do it, I will be impressed. But the reason I think it doesn't come back the way it has been is because they clearly have massively diluted the concept. Like just the dilution is incredible. Like I said, there's 1.8 million of these things, or at least that's what CoinMarketCap has. When you're brand new in a brand new market and you're the shiny new coin, and everybody saw Bitcoin skyrocket, and this is like a revolutionary, this new tech, nobody knows what the hell is going on, it's easy to sell people on the next token. But when it's been around for 5, 7, 10 years, and it's left in its wake millions of dead garbage tokens, the new one's just not so shiny anymore. So I really don't think I see this being, or see this being a huge concern, or thinking that this is going to be something that's just going to pour the entire, just like this massive, unrelenting shitcoin market into the Bitcoin system. Because at the end of the day, the more things start migrating, the more we figure out how to build on top of Bitcoin, and the more arbitrary the code is that we can do for applications on top, well, then the very notion of having a different token becomes dumber and dumber. It becomes more and more obvious that there's no reason for it. What's its differentiation if all of the reasons that all the excuses for altcoins, faster transactions, privacy, smart contracts, all of these things can now be built on Bitcoin. Well, how are you going to have a Bitcoin-derived shitcoin that tries to differentiate with one of the 10,000 things that now can all just be done on top of Bitcoin? So, and all of them still have to compete for monetary liquidity because they're all they can do is be currency units. There's nothing that ties these things to genuine underlying capital, literally except Bitcoin. So there's a long way of saying, I don't think there's a very good sell for shitcoins on top of Bitcoin. And I don't think bringing the EVM over there, over to on top of the Bitcoin system, means that we'll suddenly have this new, hugely vibrant and just like mess of new tokens and shitcoins. And this is one of the things that I said about drive chains too. Is that everybody thinks it's going to be, you know, it would bring all of the shitcoin traffic and stuff back to Bitcoin. And this would like hugely explode the market cap and everything would be better for Bitcoin and all this good stuff. And I just don't think it does. I think it does more to kill the narrative than it does give them a new boost or give breathe in new life into that game. And so it just ends up, it means more that we just have a more trust minimized way to create a pool of funds that we can just execute any code, any arbitrary code on top of it that we want. And there's no reason not to use the EVM, not because we want a bunch of shitcoins and the EVM can do that, because anything that's just arbitrary code is going to let you do as many shitcoins as you want. We could do it without the EVM. Again, it's arbitrary code. You can do whatever you want. The whole thing, all of it could just be shitcoins on top of shitcoins. There's no reason to need Ethereum code for it. The reason you would still want to use the Ethereum virtual machine is because people know how to write code in Solidity. It's like a decision to use Python because there's a lot of people who work in Python. Even better is that coming from the shitcoin market, there's a whole lot of people who know how to use Solidity, know how to create contracts and things in Solidity, which also may very well all need new jobs when you can run the EVM on top of Bitcoin. So it kind of makes a lot of practical sense to just do that first. So honestly, it will be really interesting to watch this unfold, especially knowing that there's no soft fork here. That's the big thing, is that there's no stopping this. This isn't bloat on the chain. This isn't some op return code. This isn't inscriptions or ordinals or any crap like that. This isn't a soft fork that people are going to argue over and decide. This is literally something that you do with multisig and a piece of software that looks at a bunch of hashes in the blocks. There's no stop. This shit's going to happen. But it's great for it to happen this way because nobody has to give a shit. Nobody has to care. If you don't like it, doesn't matter at all for Bitcoin. All it means is that we have a lot more multi-sig transactions, which is great. Fees will be solid. And hopefully they build it quickly and we do get high fees because I'm about to turn my miners back on for winter. I'm going to get me some of them sats. But overall, the spider chain seems like an interesting model. It seems like a really interesting model. There's a lot at play to kind of balance some of the, like, how much needs to be staked, how long of inactivity before, like, you're starting to remove stakers. Like, LOP has a bunch of good little things, like the fact that there's a lot of different characteristics that might ought to be different if the spider chain is small, but change if the spider chain gets really big and there's lots of signers, because you want to be able to have it such that there's enough signers that it's not easy to sibble from some external actor for someone to get control. But you also don't want so many signers that you then have a really bad coordination problem and trouble trying to, you know, move the peg in and peg out. And then there's the same thing with the Liquid Federation of 2/3 need to sign to peg out and 1/3 can stop it. Well, it seems like that's true for the spider chain as well. Even though it's broken up, that the cool thing is that it's actually broken up into all the individual multisigs. So only any individual multisig is at threat. But if 1/3 of the signers become unresponsive or cannot operate, then they might be frozen forever. Like that one multisig, even though it's a web of multisigs, one particular subset of funds might get locked if 33% of the signers disappear permanently. So there's a lot to unpack and kind of think about, like how this security model really works in depth. And I already reached out to the Botanics Labs to do a good show together, because I want to kind of go do like we did with ARK and kind of like hit all the edge cases and really see what happens when the security model breaks down and why, so that we can kind of get a feel for the edges of this thing, where the trade-offs exist. So we'll see what they say, and we'll be digging back into this sometime pretty soon. And if you want a slightly more deeper dive into, and Lop actually does go through a lot of things at the end of his article of like, okay, how well does the security model stand up here? What happens when there's partial inactivity versus 100% inactivity? Like just, you know, just like kind of delineating like, what are these conditions? And this is part of the reason why I want to have the Botanics guys on the show, is to go through a lot of those things as well, because I think that's where you figure out how well this works. It seems right now, at my kind of high level thing, it seems like a really clever addition to the setup of having trust minimized pools. And I like the idea specifically of figuring out how to make proof of stake work when you have an ultimate consensus that a sense of time that is genuine, that isn't based on the proof of stake. And I'm happy specifically to see this one just because I think it's beginning to open up that the door to that. And if this is even moderately successful or has an interesting impact on the sidechain space and this actually gets deployed, it will be interesting to see how much change happens in the idea of these bonds and this proof of stake, like punishment system, all this. It will just be interesting to see them, you know, begin to fine tune. Like it will only be with experimentation, with actual, you know, economic stake and a live network that will actually really see whether this thing works or not, or if it's stupid and it fails in some rather obvious way after implementing. But it's definitely something to keep our eye on. It sounds really interesting, and it sounds like it'll probably end up happening one way or the other. So let me know what you guys think. Do y'all like this proposal? What questions do you have? Particularly if you like, drop me a message on Noster, tag me in a message, or send me a fountain boost or something and put a message there. If you have any questions, that will actually be a really good basis to start from when I'm hunting through the white paper or asking the guys at Botanics. It'd just be good to have a reference of exactly what I'm looking for. So any questions are greatly appreciated, thoughts, whatever. A shout out also to the Audionauts. You guys have been a great group over there on Telegram and have been supporting the show for a really long time. And I don't mention it enough, but I really, really appreciate you guys as a resource and a crew that gets together and hangs out. And then, of course, a thank you to our amazing sponsors that keep this show running. Nodeless.io, link in the show notes to set up your donation page and get 10,000 sats. Do not forget to publish that. Tag me in your post. The Cold Card Hardware Wallet, which is where all of your Bitcoin are going to be sent to, so that you know that it's safe and you can sleep soundly at night. And then the Fold Card is what you're going to use in your fiat life to get sats back on all the things that you do. There is nothing quite as magical as earning Bitcoin when you pay your bills. Links and everything will be found in the show notes. With that, a thank you to Shinobi for this awesome piece, and I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. Until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear as it is, infinite. William Blake.